No one should doubt such measures' potential efficacy. No one wants to be wanted dead or alive. Guaranteed punishment, the certainty you will be hunted until your last day, likely coming decades earlier than your natural end, would powerfully deter all but the most ideologically besotted. Bosnia and Herzegovina's president Salijic was the country's foreign minister and then prime minister during the Serbs' eliminationist assault. He knew Milosevic well. Agreeing that Milosevic was a rational and cunning calculator of advantage, banking on attaining permanent territorial gains, Salijic said when asked whether Milosevic would have ever initiated the slaughter of Bosnians if Milosevic had known for sure he would be hunted down till his last day, "I don't think he would." Rwandan Minister of Justice Tarsis Karugarama has steeped himself, as much if not more than just about any of our time's public figures, in the problems of genocide, including preventing and combating the scourge. When I asked him whether a guarantee that anyone initiating genocide would be hunted down until killed would have prevented the Rwandan genocide and would be effective in preventing future mass slaughters, he replied with enormous emphasis, "Definitely, definitely, 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 many times definitely." Karugarama then explained, "If people knew that at the end of the day they'll be the losers, they never invest in losing an enterprise. Because genocide, as you correctly pointed out, is a political enterprise. It's a political game. But again, it's a power play. It's wealth. It's everything. So if people involved in it knew at the end of the day they'd be the losers, they would not play the game. That's for sure." Even if such a guarantee would not completely end eliminationist assaults, and it likely would not prevent every last one, it would reduce them substantially. That would save innumerable future victims' lives and prevent the expulsion and brutalizing of countless more. It would prevent incalculable suffering of still so many others, relatives, friends, community members. It would prevent the deformation of so many countries' polities, societies, and cultures. And it would lift the threat under which so many million live. And if ever a country's political leaders would not be warded off from implementing their eliminationist desires, and these political, legal, and martial countermeasures were triggered and put into effect, then all other potential mass murderers and eliminationist perpetrators would unmistakably see what awaits them should they war on humanity. One of the international arena's most powerful, underappreciated influences is learning. This, of course, is understood for economic matters, but less so for politics. To date, about eliminationist politics, political leaders have learned they can kill, expel or incarcerate hated or unwanted groups with impunity. They must now learn the opposite, which they quickly will if it turns out to be true. Impunity is over, and the opposite, guaranteed uncompromising punishment, prevails. The prevailing state of affairs, impunity for the perpetrators on the ground and in the halls of power, is illustrated poignantly in Guatemala. Despite the military and paramilitary's vast participation in the scorched earth policy against the Maya, the government's term for its eliminationist assault, to date only 10 of the genocide's material authors, as the actual killers are called, have been brought to justice. In Guatemala, I heard again and again from survivors that most of all they wanted Rios Montt and the other intellectual authors of the genocide put on trial. In CALDH, C-A-L-D-H, Center for Human Rights and Legal Action, the oldest, largest, and most prominent human rights organization in Guatemala, wanted posters of Rios Montt adorned doors and hallways. Furthermore, Guatemala's official Commission for Historical Clarification report named Rios Montt as responsible for the genocide, and Guatemala is now a tolerably well-working democracy. So where is he, the mastermind of the eliminationist assault on the Mayan people? Where is Rios Montt that he has eluded the punishment that should come to him as surely as the sun came today to Guatemala from the east? In Guatemala, untouched, free, and living the good life. What's more, he is a member of Congress. What's still more, as recently as 2005, 23 years after his stewardship of the mass murder and elimination ended, Rios Montt was nothing less than the Congress president, having in 2003 been a losing candidate to be Guatemala's president. Sitting across from Rios Montt, at one end of the horseshoe that is the seating arrangement in Congress, is Otilia Luck de Cotty, an author of the very Commission for Historical Clarification report that demonstrates beyond any doubt Rios Montt's authorship of Guatemala's largest spate of exterminationist and eliminationist assaults on the Maya, making it clear he is among our time's worst mass murderers. When I asked de Cotty in her office how she, a Maya, feels having to see him every day in Congress, she did not answer the question as it was put about her feelings, but eloquently conveyed the reality of the impunity that contemporary politics offers the leaders guilty of exterminationist and eliminationist politics. "It is a political matter, Daniel," she explained, setting the frame for her answer, the frame of politics. "I have to speak with God and the devil. To negotiate a law, I must speak with them all." In saying this, she revealed her bottled-up feelings and why they must remain corked. After talking to de Cotty, I walked with her to Congress, where from the press gallery I watched Rios Montt talk amiably with his fellow legislators, vote, occupy his honored place in the august chamber. There, with a film crew preparing the documentary grounded in this book, I confronted him as he emerged from the chamber into the hallway and pursued him as he walked by without answering the question I posed. To my surprise, as we emerged from the passageway into the Congress building's entrance hall, Rios Montt stopped, turned to me, and indicated he would speak. I asked, "Was there genocide in Guatemala, and were you responsible?" Rios Montt tried to exonerate himself by falsely stating the Genocide Convention's definition of genocide, which I immediately corrected, and then, after he, somewhat flustered, accepted what I said, I asked him again whether he agrees he is responsible for the genocide. His reply, perhaps rhetorically powerful to the innocent, was, to anyone informed, a laugher. "If I was responsible, I would be in jail." As I laid out the charges against him, he said, "Show me the proof and accuse me before any court." So I asked him whether he would go to Spain to face an indictment against him for genocide. He replied that his lawyers will not let him go. In this surrealistic discussion with the Hitler of Guatemala, I said, "There's nothing preventing you from getting on a plane with a passport and going to Spain." Telling me he has already lived in Spain long enough, Rios Montt, the genocidal mastermind, knows that after more than a quarter century of immunity, he can thumb his nose at justice, even mocking it by saying that if he were guilty, he would be in jail. Every democracy has laws, police forces, courts, and prisons to punish criminals and to deter its citizens and others within the country from committing crimes. Without these institutions, criminality would be far greater, so rampant as to render democracy, civil life, even society itself, impossible. Everyone recognizes this explicitly or implicitly for his or her own society. Yet internationally, analogous robust institutions that potential exterminationist and eliminationist perpetrators know put them automatically in a determined international community's crosshairs do not exist. No wonder eliminationist assaults have been so frequent. Anyone scoffing at efforts to create such analogous, effective international institutions to deter perpetrators, rulers of countries, state and governmental officials, and the killing field's executioners from initiating and participating in exterminationist and eliminationist assaults to deter them from conducting war against humanity must be moved by something other than regard for future victims' lives. He either does not genuinely want to reduce such colossal atrocities incidents, or privileges his other priorities, such as safeguarding his own personal or parochial political or academic aspirations. To be sure, domestic institutions meant to prevent crime are imperfectly effective. Crime exists. The international institutions and measures proposed here to prevent eliminationist attacks would also sometimes fail. But there is every reason to believe such measures would often work, just as the analogous domestic institutions do, that prevent the incalculably vast amount of crime people would commit without them. No one would opt to reduce his own society's law enforcement to the crippled state of the international community's means for preventing, stopping, and punishing genocide, let alone eliminations all but ignored other forms, including non-genocidal mass murders. So why should anyone pretend this current international state of affairs is anything but ineffective and undesirable, and scandalous? If somehow these preventive measures fail or seem about to fail, then the new anti-genocide, anti-eliminationist international dispensation, codified among other places in a revised genocide convention and revised international criminal court, should provide member states standing authorization, alone or in concert, to intervene in the ways discussed here. In addition to its many other problems, the Genocide Convention does not currently empower such intervention, permitting member states only to refer the problem to the United Nations in the hopeless hope an institution set up to do nothing might do something. These prescriptions do not include an obligation to intervene. This is not because I oppose such an obligation. To the contrary, I think it exists as a moral principle and would support it wholeheartedly as a political and legal one. But such an obligation is that much less likely to be enshrined in law and international institutions than the enabling measures suggested here. Pragmatically, it is wiser to work toward institutions and laws demanding less of participating states, particularly when they are as likely or almost as likely to work as the preventive measures outlined here would. Nevertheless, it is worth laying out more robust contours of prevention, intervention, and justice regimes. The international watchdog organization would monitor the world for signs an eliminationist onslaught may be on the way, identify when it looks possible, and trigger preventive intervention to forestall it. Some signs are well known: the declaration of a state of emergency or martial law, the suspension of civil liberties, restrictions placed on foreign diplomats and international organizations' representatives, the widespread closing down of media outlets or access, and intensified fanning of hatred and fear of an ethnic, religious, linguistic, or political group by government-controlled or inspired media. The watchdog organization and independent member states would adopt well-established and publicized procedures and measures that every country's political leaders and elites would already know. Author's note: diplomatic and other aid would simultaneously be offered to help the threatening leadership defuse the situation. But with an effective and universally known preventive system of this sort in place, any country that would go so far as to trigger its robust anti-eliminationist measures would likely be well past the point where conventional diplomacy would work. They would formally warn the threatening country, especially its political, security, and business leaders, that the international community will respond to any eliminationist measures with all its means and power. The warning would further clearly convey that the threatening country's political leadership, including all cabinet ministers and high officials in military and police organizations, will be declared in a state of war against humanity and will be hunted down until killed or arrested, with a bounty on their heads ranging from $100,000 to $10 million. The country would be bombarded with radio broadcasts, internet postings, email, voicemail, and leaflets warning its people against participating in or supporting any such violent measures. The country would also be required to permit the International Rapid Deployment Force to enter and act freely to ensure no eliminationist violence occurs. If it refuses, then such troops could be forcibly inserted, with participating countries' naval, air, and ground forces further mobilization, which might also mean deposing the country's leadership. If a country's political leaders deem the new preventive, interventionist, and punishment regime's practices and past successes insufficiently persuasive, and if their followers in high political and military positions are equally blithe about their own safety and futures, and manage to take the international watchdog organization unawares and initiate mass murder, expulsion, or incarceration, then that organization would immediately notify the relevant international institutions and the world community, triggering the interventionist measures to stop it as quickly as possible. A bombing campaign to destroy the country's military infrastructure would immediately commence. Only military targets, including airfields, depots, bases, and ships, would be attacked to minimize civilian deaths and damage to the country's general infrastructure. Such bombing's purpose, as it effectively was against the Serbs, is more to raise the cost to the eliminationist regime's military and political leaders, it would often threaten their hold on power, than to weaken their capacity to proceed, because, as we and they know, perpetrators can quickly slaughter people by the tens of thousands without sophisticated weaponry. Military ground intervention would begin quickly to stop the killing and eliminationist violence and to topple the enemies of humanity constituting the outlaw regime. Author's note: the possible rejoinder that this will empower states to use the right to intervene against eliminationism as a flimsy pretext to invade other countries is not well grounded. States wishing to invade others will do so regardless, and the powerful reasons preventing states from doing so, deterrence, international interventionist measures, and the many costs war entails, which inherently destabilizes tyrannies making war, will operate forcefully and effectively just as it otherwise does. Complex and difficult nation-building measures would need to follow, ideally under international supervision. Varying enormously from instance to instance, they would include providing justice with all its complexities, impossibilities, and unhappy choices and compromises. All these measures to intervene to stop eliminationist assaults are unlikely to occur. Only a naïf would expect that in the foreseeable future, say the next 5 to 15 years, such robust anti-genocide, let alone anti-eliminationist, pro-human institutions and laws will be created, actors lined up, and policies enacted, and then, when necessary, be used appropriately. Many might say that, given the international state system, 50 years would not be enough. States governed by self-interested political leaders and responsive to publics concerned overwhelmingly with their own countries are unlikely to intervene to stop mass murder, let alone lesser eliminations, costing substantial sums and the lives of their country's soldiers. And it is difficult to see the United Nations, the leading and currently unavoidable international institution, facilitating such morally positive developments. That is why focusing on preventive measures is more likely to succeed and, for the other reasons discussed here, be more efficacious. Cynics, many thinking themselves hard-headed realists, might say the proposed preventive measures are equally unlikely to be enacted. To this, there are several rejoinders. Such preventive measures, demanding less and requiring less coordination, are by definition easier to bring about. Even if not, those wishing to reduce eliminationist politics' incidence and vast toll should lay out a feasible pathway while recognizing that gathering support will take time. If only in one instance bounties work or one country intervenes, saving thousands or tens of thousands and giving pause to future potential perpetrators, it will be worth it. And here, reason for hope exists. Just as one political leader or a small group of political leaders initiates eliminationist onslaughts, so too can one political leader or a small number of leaders in one country or a cooperating few initiate measures to prevent or stop a mass extermination or elimination. Even if only one powerful country's leader did so once, the success would be enormous, providing an example, an unmistakable challenge, a model for others. In thinking about ways to combat eliminationist politics, especially mass murder, we are blinded by misleading analyses and overwhelmed by the problem's colossal scope. We do not see two facts: one moral person, the President of the United States, or a few such people leading a few countries in Europe or elsewhere, can positively change forever the eliminationist equation. And even if he or they are not such moral leaders, they, their advisors, and American congresspersons and other countries' parliamentarians should be politically pressured so their political and reputational interests will be to do the right thing. Second, succeeding in just one place would produce enormous positive aspects, save and prevent the ruination of lives, and effects, demonstration to future potential perpetrators and possible interveners. If we enacted a policy reducing an American city's murder rate by 50%, saving in 1 year 400 lives in New York, or even 55 in Atlanta or 40 in Boston, we would declare it an enormous achievement. Studies would be done so the effective methods could be applied elsewhere. Its architects would be celebrated. But if an imperfect but genuine anti-eliminationist regime prevented only one mass murder of tens of thousands, but not others, or cut one short while others went on, cynics and critics would scoff at its failures, even as they have for decades failed every day to take the obvious feasible steps to save lives, typically of Africans and Asians and Latin Americans. Similarly, even if one nation is rebuilt, even if only some eliminationist assaults are stopped, then such a policy's success would be historic, dwarfing the many ballyhooed initiatives marginally improving life in industrialized democracies. Anyone saying that intervention in Rwanda would have been folly, no matter that the United Nations was obstructionist and international law provided no other clear mechanism for sanctioning intervention, ought to be condemned. Implementing any of these provisions, especially the preventive ones, would be progress. If international law is not appropriately changed, then the signatories to the convention establishing the International Watchdog Organization to stop exterminationist and eliminationist onslaughts could still act upon its provisions. The convention's signatories, it can be 2 or 5 or 50, ought to operate under the obvious humanitarian and humane principle moving NATO in Bosnia and Kosovo. Eliminationist onslaughts, mass murders, expulsions, incarcerations, and rapes must be stopped. They should invoke and further the developing norm of responsibility to protect, which the UN Security Council and therefore international law at least implicitly recognizes. No real adverse international consequences will befall states acting to save innocents' lives. Even without such an international watchdog organization, single states or supranational entities, certainly the United States or the European Union, or small ad hoc groups, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, can save lives by preventing or stopping wars against humanity. The second necessary preventive measure is reducing the number of regimes with strong tendencies to practice eliminationist politics and replace them with the democratic institutions that rob political leaders of the ready institutional and cultural means to initiate domestic slaughters or eliminations. Many political leaders pay lip service to increasing democratic governance, but do little to bring it about. That topic also deserves a separate book. The problem's crux is twofold: the United Nations and sovereignty. The United Nations, as we now know, enables, even legitimizes, dictatorships. Freedom House, a non-governmental organization, assesses every country's degree of freedom using two major dimensions: political rights, including a functioning electoral democracy, and civil liberties. In 2009, out of 193 countries, only 89 are free, while more than half, 104, are partly free, 62, or not free, 42. Only 119, 62%, are electoral democracies. So more than a third of the current UN membership consists of non-democratic regimes, namely criminal regimes. By broader measures of freedom, more than half the UN membership is tyrannies, committing substantial or colossal crimes and human rights violations against their own peoples. Imagine your country was run with more than one-third, perhaps even more than half of the voters, hardened, felonious criminals. Your laws are made only with their acquiescence. Your enforcement of legal measures depends on their agreement or participation, with their representatives staffing much of the enforcement mechanism's implementation. Imagine they controlled, absolutely and with utter impunity, not just their own households, but entire towns, cities, and regions. Such is the United Nations. This immense international problem is barely mentioned and is effectively not part of international or domestic political discourse, let alone where it should be, at the center of concern, thinking, and policy development. Many American commentators, predominantly Republican in orientation, despise the United Nations mainly because it is the principal international forum and instrument for contesting and constraining American power. They disdain multilateralism in general and the undeniable hostility the United Nations mobilizes against the United States. Similarly, those suspicious of and seeking a counterweight to American power, or simply hoping the international community can become an actual community, reflexively support and wish to expand the United Nations' power. The United Nations, aside from the World Trade Organization for Economic Matters, is the major overarching international institution and forum for the world's countries to cooperate and solve disputes peacefully. This, in addition to the enormous good its agencies, such as the World Health Organization, perform, is the principal point in its favor. For these reasons, the United Nations' fundamentally illegitimate nature and its enabling of tyranny remain world politics' dirty secrets, barely an issue in Europe and the industrial world, let alone in the developing world, home to scores of criminal regimes and tyrants, which look to the United Nations to give their voices weight and support their illegitimate claims to legitimacy. The United Nations is treated more as a revered institution and model for the world than as the fundamentally corrupt, undemocratic, and anti-democratic institution it is. This alone, aside from its administration's additional corrupt aspects, ought to disqualify Democrats and people of goodwill from supporting it, no matter the good it may perform. We should do away with the United Nations and replace it with a powerful international institution carrying out many of its current duties and functions, but not suffering its disqualifying deformities. We should do this not because the United Nations constrains American power or is hostile to many American positions, but because it is illegitimate and ineffectual and corrupt, and does far too little to coordinate the world's countries to alleviate misery, including to fight against exterminationist and eliminationist politics. The United Nations sits on a conceptual foundation, its charter, that for the foreseeable future all but guarantees its continuing enabling of mass murder, other eliminations, mass brutality, denial of basic democratic and civil libertarian rights to billions, and slowed economic development. The United Nations should be replaced with an institution without foundational principles and membership promoting these horrors and abominations. This institution could therefore be true to the United Nations name and ignored conceptual foundation, namely the second part of its name, nations, not states sitting above, often tyrannically, the people, but the people composing each nation. This leads to the second problem, state sovereignty. Sovereignty exists not for nations or countries' peoples, it exists for states. The notion of sovereignty came into being, law, and international politics, beginning with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, a non-democratic age of monarchs ruling peoples, not of self-governing citizens. International politics deems states, no matter how atrocious their rulers, sovereign. This unjustifiable conception of international relations made some sense so long as war was a common option, thus rightly orienting the beneficent impulses in international politics toward reducing its incidence. State sovereignty contributed to this by constraining states' capacities to intervene in other states' affairs, diminishing conflict points, and contributing to a more ordered, predictable, and stable international environment. But today, state or ruler's sovereignty, as opposed to national or people's sovereignty, is indefensible. Interstate war and its threat has declined considerably. Respecting the sovereignty of criminal states, namely non-democracies and tyrannies, does not reduce war, but promotes it. It is non-democratic states and leaders that still use war to aggrandize territory, expand power, seek glory, and accrue economic gains. Furthermore, given the great emerging eliminationist danger of nuclear weapons proliferation to non-democratic rogue states, or non-state actors finding safe harbor in such states, the threat tyrannies pose to peoples outside their borders is growing exponentially. And because it is indisputable that, absent emergency circumstances or a governing party's eliminationist conduct, a country's people should determine their government, the indefensibility of respecting, legitimizing, and supporting dictators, tyrants, and murderers becomes absolute. The world's democracies must stop promoting and safeguarding the world's tyrants, including their capacity to practice eliminationist politics, from mass murder to mass expulsions to violently repressing those not conforming to their narrow ethnocentric, ideological, or religious prescriptions. Democratic leaders and the world's peoples should stop perpetuating this legal, institutional, and political fiction, most glaringly at the United Nations, that tyrannical regimes and leaders represent anything aside from their own criminal, war-making, and eliminationist interests. Democracies should assiduously work to reduce the number of such regimes, which, as we now know, are inherently unstable and weak, being actually or potentially threatened by the demands of their country's peoples to be represented and treated fairly, and inherently prone to eliminationism. Creating a world of democracies is the only effective long-term strategy to prevent nuclear weapon use. Democratic leaders and peoples should replace the United Nations with a new United Democratic Nations that admits only democracies, an idea John McCain also floated while running for the American presidency. But instead of his League of Democracies, it should be democracies united against tyranny, genocide, and all eliminationist politics, and united for the world's people. Democracies should similarly make membership in other international political and economic organizations open only to democracies. They should place prohibitions on their companies doing business in non-democratic countries. There will be short-term costs, acrimony, tension, and harm done to the people under tyrannical regimes refusing to relinquish their anti-human power. Yet many non-democratic regimes and their sustaining economic elites will see tyranny's continuing costs as prohibitive. Most tyrants and the supporting elites follow calculations of power and advantage. Making democracy a much better cost-benefit option will powerfully appeal to their cherished values and interests, and further create within their countries self-reinforcing societal and economic pressure and support for democracy. Such incentives' power to induce political and economic elites and countries' peoples to opt for democracy is more than a logical conclusion. The evidence for democratizing political and economic pressure's enormous effectiveness exists. The European Union has required countries seeking membership to meet genuine democratic and other criteria, in Freedom House's terms, political rights and civil liberties. NATO has further contributed to this pressure. Consequently, Central and Eastern European countries, as well as Turkey, which otherwise might not have embraced democracy or fallen away from it, saw democracy as the only option. Quickly, despite a highly unpromising starting point, the region transformed from wholly undemocratic and unfree into an almost wholly democratic and free one. Similarly, when in the late 1980s the United States stopped supporting Latin American tyrannies, making it clear that the military overthrow of democracy, the previous decade's common occurrence, would lead to political and economic isolation, Latin America, except the communist anachronism Cuba, became near wholly democratic and mainly free. Establishing and governing a united democratic nations would meet some problems. What actually qualifies as a genuine democracy or a free country, rather than a sham democracy such as Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe, even before the fraudulently overturned 2008 election? Dealing with the non-democratic colossus China and the ever more problematic democracy, increasingly authoritarian Russia, is a substantial stumbling block. Identifying sham democracies, as Freedom House shows, is not difficult. Still, some judgment calls would be necessary and likely imperfect. Nevertheless, the difficulty of getting every case right does not justify getting all the obvious ones wrong by maintaining the tyrannical status quo. And there is no reason to succumb to carping holier-than-thous, cynics, or the illegitimate and injurious status quo's dissimulating defenders who would maintain that admitting partly or wholly fake democracies and unfree countries into the United Democratic Nations would poison and therefore nullify the entire project. With China, the largest problem, the diplomatic thing to do in both senses of diplomacy is to make an exception. If necessary, the same should be done with Russia. Practical principles occasional compromise to further other far more important practical principles is preferable to the alternative of sacrificing them all, in this case, supporting all the world's tyrants and brutes. Noble inconsistency, including not applying an operative principle to a few cases, trumps consistently applying the principle to no one, therefore standing by as tyrants brutalize, expel and kill millions, and repress and suppress hundreds of millions more. To be sure, it would be better if the international system were not the anarchic and essentially lawless place it is, and we could devise a set of solutions to the problems of its governance that are desirable and doable. But as the treacherous and difficult international system is the real context for our making choices about how to proceed, the urgent need to save lives and improve the horrifying conditions under which so many people live powerfully argues for these proposals, which are superior to all others. Democracy is no panacea, yet in sum, it is human existence's boon. Democracy should be a prerequisite for deeming a country's government legitimate. Those attacking this approach, arguing that insistently promoting democracy and political and civil rights is ineffective or dangerous, ignore the facts. When it has been tried, such as in Western Europe after World War II, by the European Union in Southern, Central, and Eastern Europe, and by the United States in Latin America, it has worked brilliantly. The final substantial hurdle is to motivate the world's democracies to organize themselves to create a more democratic, secure, and prosperous world. The cost would not be great. Praise would likely far exceed criticism. Over time, international governances and then steadily national governances reordering would enhance democratic countries' security and lower their costs, including the colossal direct and indirect economic costs of dealing with the human and economic destruction the world's many undemocratic and tyrannical regimes cause. A serious international prevention, intervention, and punishment regime to stop mass murderous and eliminationist states and leaders from warring on their peoples and humanity, and a devoted international push for democratizing more countries to remove the institutional and political and cultural basis for political leaders to even see eliminationist politics as an option are the basis for a more secure, more global structure that would greatly end eliminationist politics, mass violence, and vast destructiveness. Even if both are not simultaneously brought about or achieved only in part, establishing just one will save the lives and prevent the misery of untold millions of men, women, and children. The alternative is to wait around yet again, to wait until one or another, and then another, and then another of the manifestly proto-eliminationist regimes governing more than half the world's countries decide to enact an elimination or genocide and slaughters, expels, or incarcerates and inflicts countless other cruelties on masses of people. How can we, in good faith as moral beings, as citizens of our countries, and as human beings belonging to a common humanity, choose to permit this to happen? How can we choose not to take simple and effective steps to prevent future wars against humanity? This concludes Worse Than War.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.